What I would like to talk to you about today is possibly the most heroic American whose name you have never heard before. If I were asked for a show of hands, there might be two of you that would know this name. I've made this presentation several times, and it's just not a very well-known name. But I want to tell you his amazing story today. And the reason I want to tell you that story is because, in very important ways, his story is our story. His story is your story, it's my story, as far as what he was about and what he needed to do, what he did, and the results of it. So if we can have the first slide, I'm going to have to cue these verbally. This is the man that I'm going to tell you about today, rather unusual name, Elihu B. Benjamin Washburn. Elijah Washburn was born in 1816 in Livermore, Maine, and he had a very hard childhood. His father was not a very good businessman. We heard about that in the announcements. His business failed, he contracted debts, and his children were basically farmed out to work off the debts of the family business. So Elihu had to work through much of his youth to pay off the family debts. All summer long, he worked from dawn till dusk, digging stumps, driving oxen to the plow, cutting and putting up hay, all of which for which he was paid $5 a month. That was what he was paid to help pay off the family debts. He left home, I think rather understandably, at the age of 17 and decided he'd live his life on his own. He was going to try to do something else. And so he did a variety of different jobs until at age 20 decided he wanted to study law. And he had a friend, a benefactor, who helped pay his way through the main law school at the time, which was Harvard. He passed the bar exam. And he moved to Illinois. Illinois was the frontier in those days. That's about as far as you could go to the West. And there was a great demand for lawyers in this place that was really humming with activity. He established a very good reputation as a hardworking man. And in 1852, he was elected to Congress. And while he was serving in Washington, D.C., he became friends with another Illinois politician, a certain Abraham Lincoln. And about that time, he also met a junior army officer, Ulysses S. Grant, a lieutenant at the time, and he became friends with these two men. Washburn campaigned for Lincoln. He was a close advisor of Abraham Lincoln during his presidency. And during that time, he also visited Grant pretty frequently at the front. I think we probably understand that today, but it was hard for the president to get accurate information about what was going on in the war, even though it was just a couple of hours ride away because, you know, people were telling their own sides of what happened, etc. So Washburn would often go to the front and bring back eyewitness reports. This is what's going on. This is what's happening with the army. He became close friends with Ulysses Grant. And later on, in 1869, President Grant, then president, appointed Elihu Washburn ambassador to France. He became the ambassador to France. And there was a bit of sniping that went on because he was just a frontier bumpkin, didn't have a lot of education or culture. How could he represent the United States to the most cultured country in the world, to France? This is a terrible choice, people were saying. He's not the kind of person we want representing us in France. But Grant had great trust in him. That's interesting. When he first arrived in France, he explained the reasons why he enjoyed international travel so much. He said, "My great enjoyment in being abroad is being away from home, out of the incessant turmoil, strife, labor, and excitement of political life. I need a break." He could not imagine that he was about to go through one of the worst periods in a long history of France, and he was going to be there right in the middle. You see, for several years prior to his appointment to Paris, over in Prussia is the part of Germany that's around Berlin, and at that time there was no Germany, there were just a collection of principalities, each with its own prince. Sometimes they called themselves kings, but essentially they were princes. Well, Otto von Bismarck, who was the chancellor of the Prince of Prussia, the area around Berlin, He'd been working to convince all the other German principalities that they should lump together in one new country under the King of Prussia, who would then become the Emperor of Greater Germany. Bismarck was a brilliant man, a genius, and he decided the best way to get all the principalities to league together was to declare war on France, or to have a war with France, and to win. Because if little Prussia could beat France, which just a few years earlier under Napoleon Bonaparte had dominated all of Europe, well, that would convince the other Prussian the other German principalities, that they needed to league together. And so through a series, I won't go into all the details, but he managed to just keep bothering and insulting the French until the point where finally they declared war on Prussia. And so that happened on July 15th, 1870. When you think about the Franco-Prussian War, this is just 5 years after the American Civil War ended. So uniforms and weaponry and all of that is going to be very much the same. And you probably don't know very much about the Franco-Prussian War. I didn't until I moved to France. That was in my backyard, those battlefields, when I was a pastor over there. So I did learn quite a bit about it. Napoleon III, who was a nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte, was the Emperor of France at that time. They'd had the French Revolution. Then Napoleon Bonaparte took over. He had himself declared emperor. And then there were a series of emperors. There was no republic. It was an empire at the time. And wanting to cash in on the family name, Napoleon, right, one of the great military leaders of world history, he led the French army off to the border with Prussia, northern Germany, to fight this war. The French army had a wonderful reputation, but it was very poorly supplied. It was very badly organized. It was nothing like the French army under Napoleon Bonaparte. And the German army was led not only by Bismarck, but by William I, who was a professional soldier. He'd spent his whole life in the military, and he was the first professional soldier to sit on the Prussian throne since Frederick the Great. As the war began, all of the ambassadors of the great powers left Paris. They were told by their governments, you don't have to stay. This is going to be dangerous. You should just take your family and get out. Elihu Washburn was told by President Grant, you don't have to stay. You are free to leave. But he wrote this: this is my place where duty calls me, and here I must remain. This is my place where duty calls me, and here I must remain. Certain careers, certain callings, certain commitments require people to stay at their post, even in difficult and even in dangerous circumstances. Christianity, true Christianity, is such a calling. We have been called to a posting. We're called to be spiritual warriors in a challenging time. Of course, all of human history has been challenging for true Christians, but we are called to a post, and we are called to do our duty, very much the way Elihu B. Washburn understood his responsibility. Turn with me, if you would, to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 14. Philippians 2, verse 14. Paul wrote to the Christians at Philippi. He said, do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God, without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, hold fast the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain or labored in vain. That is our calling. That is our post. Christianity is our post in the middle of a crooked and perverse generation. It's not an easy posting, but it is our duty. That's where God has stationed us to be. It's never been easy since Christ founded the church. It hasn't been easy for our predecessors in the faith. But we know from prophecy it's going to get more challenging as time moves forward, as we go to the crescendo of the end of the age of man. What the Bible calls in Galatians 1 verse 4, this present evil age. That's what we live in, the present evil age. That's your post. That's my post. And we must stay at our post and do our duty. I first began studying the life of Elihu Washburn in preparation for a presentation that I made at the Winter Family Weekend this year. I don't know if any of you were there, but you probably know or remember or heard at least that the theme of the Winter Family Weekend this year was Armor Up. And it was talking about the whole armor of God. And several of us who made presentations there read the passage in Ephesians chapter 6 that talks about that. Let's look at it. Ephesians 6. Ephesians chapter 6, starting in verse 10. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful in the end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am ambassador in chains, and that I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. That's a passage of the Bible we know well. You've probably read and studied that before. The whole armor of God and the different elements of it and the good that it does, the protection that it affords. I won't go into that in great detail. I'll just note a few things in passing, though. It says in verse 11 that we need the whole armor of God. We don't want to leave any unprotected parts, spiritually speaking. We need every element of that. Verse 12 talks about the wiles of the devil. Someone who has wiles is wily. It means he's sneaky. He's cunning. He plans ahead. He looks for weak spots, and that's where he attacks. We have a malevolent, tricky, and absolutely merciless adversary. He has no pity. There's no remorse. He just wants to kill us. Verse 13 talks about being able to stand in the evil day. And that means there are going to come particular moments, crunch times, if you will, spiritually speaking, crucial moments, turning points, times of especially dire trial. That's going to happen in the lives of all of us. All of our preparations will be plumbed and tested and probed. There will come evil days. And then in verse 18, it says, watching to this end with all perseverance. Perseverance is not technically listed as a part of the armor of God, but it is a big part of it. Sometimes the crucial quality of succeeding as a Christian will be perseverance. It will be hanging on. It will be being stubborn at that evil day, tying a knot in the end of our rope and just hanging on. One of the lessons of the parable of the sower and the seed is the necessity of endurance, of hanging on, of persevering. Let's look at that in Matthew chapter 13. Matthew 13, starting in verse 1. Matthew chapter 13, verse 1. On the same day, Jesus went out from the house and sat by the sea. And a great multitude were gathered together to him, so that he got into a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. That's our equivalent of having a microphone today. He just went out a little bit. His words would echo off the water. Everybody could hear. Thousands of people could hear what he had to say. And he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, "Behold, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell among thorns, and thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Which is something Jesus often said, because most of the people who heard him didn't have ears to hear. It was only revealed to a very few. And we are very blessed to be among those who have ears to hear now. We can get it. We can understand what these things mean. Move down, please, now to verse 18. Jesus explains the parable. "Therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom, he does not understand it. Then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received seed by the wayside. But he who received the seed on stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no root in himself," not deep. "When tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles." This is not someone who's going to stand to his post and do his duty in the evil day. "He who receives seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches chokes the word, and he becomes unfruitful. But he who receives seed in the good ground is he who hears the word and understands, and who indeed bears fruit and produces some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. We see in a couple of places there in this parable that one of the key necessities for Christian success is endurance. It's just having enough depth to bear up under the difficult things that can happen to us, to stay at our post. So my message for us today, brethren, the point of the sermon, is to encourage all of us to fix our minds and our spirits and to ask God's help regularly to be able to do this, for the strength to do it, to fix our will to say, "I will stand to my post, I will do my duty, come what may," just like Elihu Washburn did. In early August 1871, Washburn, along with the rest of France and much of the rest of the world, was awaiting news of what had happened in the war in the province of Lorraine. In the 6 weeks after the outbreak of the war, as ambassador from the United States, Washburn helped over 3,000 Americans make their way out of Paris and go someplace safe. The mood of the city was full of anger and hatred for anyone who spoke German, and there were a lot of poor German-speaking people working in Paris. That was the largest city in Europe, one of the largest in the world. So German workers were arrested as spies. Some were shot. Others streamed to the American embassy. They heard that the American ambassador was there and that he might help them. The Prussian government actually sent the equivalent of $600,000 to Elihu Washburn so that he could help German-speaking people get out of France and get back to their homes safely once again. He began visiting prisons. He began intervening to help get innocent workers out of jail. He gave sums of money to help their families survive while they were waiting for the father to be released. So not only was he helping Americans leave Paris and France, he was helping many thousands of mostly poor German refugees survive and get out of France to get back home again. The American legation under Elihu Washburn helped 30,000 North Germans from the north part of Germany leave France and make it back to their home. The American embassy also set up a mobile hospital, which they called the American Ambulance, but it was actually a mobile clinic, and it was one of the best equipped ones in the city of Paris. So if we can have the next slide. This doesn't seem like a very important part of a very big part of France. Okay, looks like we're sticking on the technology here for a moment. It'll be up in a moment, I'm sure. I just want to show you where this battle happened. There we go. So where that little red circle is, that's the area that's the border between France and the North German Federation. There were several principalities that were working together, but not all of them were at this time. Next slide. So this is where the battle occurred. And as I mentioned to you, it's very interesting to me because that was my pastorate for about 6 years. So I drove through these battlefields and we had church members that lived around this place. This is a very fought over part of France, I can tell you, going back to the Roman period. So next slide. The battles looked very much like the American Civil War would have been. As I said, it was only 5 years after the Civil War occurred. And then, next slide. This is what the Prussians looked like in their uniforms. On September 3rd, news arrived that the French army had been decisively defeated at the city of Sedan, as we would say it, Sedan in French, and Emperor Napoleon III had been captured with his entire army. Next slide. This is a depiction of Napoleon III on the left and Bismarck on the right. They actually did sit down and have a chat after Napoleon was captured. They weren't going to shoot each other, so they just sat down and talked about what was going on there at the time. So the French army was captured. The emperor had to go into exile. That was the end of the French Empire. The French government, the people in Paris, decided that they would be a republic once again, and they declared a republic. And Elihu Washburn asked Washington, can we be the first country to recognize this new republic, which was similar to the kind of government that the United States has. America was the first country to recognize this new French Republic. But surprisingly enough, even though the army had been captured, the French government refused to surrender. So Prussian General von Moltke ordered, nach Paris, we will march on Paris. And so they started marching from eastern France toward the city of Paris, and Parisians prepared for a siege. There were still walls around Paris at the time. There were big bastions. And they brought in all the sheep and the goats and the cows, as much food as they possibly could within the walls of the city. And on September 17th, the Prussian army arrived, surrounded the city of Paris, and the siege began. It was going to last 4.5 months. And Elihu B. Washburn was going to be there in the middle of it that whole time. There were daily artillery bombardments. During the winter of 1870-1871, the River Seine that flows through Paris froze solid. That explains how cold it was. There wasn't enough fuel to keep warm. Every tree was cut down to burn, and then there were no more trees. Citizens froze to death. Food stores ran low. Butcher shops sold first cows and goats and sheep, then horses and mules, then dogs and cats, and finally rats. And the price was quite high. That was the only kind of meat that was available to most people. Pneumonia, smallpox, cholera killed thousands of Parisians under those difficult circumstances. As many as 4,000 died a week, which was 4 times the normal number of people who died in Paris. And during this time, Washburn negotiated with Bismarck. He had the ability to send diplomatic messages back and forth. He got permission from Bismarck. All the Americans who had stayed that long, they could still leave if they wanted to. Bismarck agreed. And finally, after 4.5 months, on January 28th, an armistice was signed. The Prussians retreated. Next slide. So this is during the siege. These are enthusiastic university students going to the walls to fight off the Prussians, and they were massacred. Next slide. Prussian artillery bombardments on the city of Paris. The beautiful city of Paris was pockmarked and terribly destroyed. Next slide. Gives you an idea of what some of the devastation was like in the City of Lights. Next slide. Finally, the Prussians held their maneuvers in Paris. So this is the Prussian cavalry and artillery right by the Eiffel Tower, the place where the Eiffel Tower was going to be built a little bit later, the Champ de Mars. They had their maneuvers, they celebrated their great victory, and they went home. But not before one other thing happened. Next slide. If you've ever been to the Palace of Versailles in Paris, you probably recognize this room. This is called the Hall of Mirrors. It's the centerpiece of the Palace of Versailles. Would you believe that the Germans declared the foundation of the German Empire not in Berlin? They did it in Paris, in the Palace of Versailles. This is Wilhelm I being crowned Emperor of Greater Germany. And that was the Germany that was going to cause several world wars and the deaths of millions of people over the next few years. But of course, that was all in the future at this point. Nobody really knew that was yet happening. So the Prussians left. They went home. And everyone breathed a big sigh of relief, including Elihu Washburn, if you look at his journal. Unfortunately, the worst was yet to come. The worst was yet to come. And we'll get to that in just a moment. Elihu Washburn needed to do some things that were actually very simple to understand. It wasn't hard to understand what he needed to do. He needed to help Americans get out of Paris. He needed to help innocent Germans get back to their country, out of Paris and France. He needed to maintain good relationship between his country and his country of residence, to which he had been appointed ambassador. None of that was really hard to understand, but it was made extremely difficult because of the circumstances going on around him, because of the war, because of the bombardments. His own house was hit by artillery. Because of the shortages of food, it became very difficult for everyone. Not hard to understand, but hard to do. Does that sound a little familiar about Christianity? Christianity is really not that hard to understand. We got kind of 10 rules. That basically sums it up. If you get those 10 down, you're doing good. 10 rules. Our children can understand the rudiments of Christianity. It's not hard to understand. But is it hard to do? Oh yeah, sometimes it is. Not because it's difficult to understand, but because of all the things that are going on around us, and even because of our own human nature. It's hard to fulfill Christianity because of external conditions, because of opposition we receive from people that we know. Self-interested people, fearful people, people who want to manipulate us to do this or that, people who have their own ideas of the way things should be, and they want to convince us that we should do that. Now, Christianity is not hard to understand. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13 and 14 talks about what's man's whole duty. What is our duty? Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man, it says in the Old King James, or in the New King James, this is man's all. That's our mission. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. That's our mission. That's our posting. Learn God's will. Do it. Easy to understand. But I think we probably all agree the way society's going, it's going to get harder and harder to actually live that way, because there's going to be a lot of opposition from people who hate this way of life. They hate this way of life, and they're going to bring pressure on us. They're going to bring active opposition. We will be the focus of hatred if we haven't already been. And we need to be prepared for that. We need to be prepared emotionally. We need to be prepared spiritually for that, because it's coming. Matthew chapter 10, please. Matthew chapter 10. Starting in verse 16. Jesus didn't hide this from his disciples. He's not hidden it from us either. Not sure that's going to make it much easier, but at least we're forewarned. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. That doesn't sound very good. You've seen sheep before. You've seen wolves, at least in documentaries. That's not going to end well for the sheep, unless there's some intervention. Therefore, be wise as serpents, and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. Scourging is whipping. And you will be brought before governors and kings for my namesake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now brother will deliver up brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another, for assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It's enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, one of Satan's names, how much more will they call those of his household? We could be called that at some point. Therefore, do not fear them, for there's nothing covered that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul, or soul and body, rather, in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will confess before my Father who is in heaven. And I would invite you to ponder that for a moment. What does that mean? Jesus said, him I will confess before my Father. You Bible doesn't really give many more details of what that's going to, how that's going to happen, but I'll share my idea of it with you. I think there's going to be a kind of an awards ceremony, and Jesus Christ is going to call people out individually, and he's going to confess their names. He's going to mention them to the Father. Father, here's your daughter, and I know you know what she did, but I want to tell you her name and explain to you what she did for you. Wow. Can you imagine something like that happening? That's what he said. Whoever confesses me before men, him I will confess before my Father who's in heaven. You want to talk about an award ceremony to end all award ceremonies? That's it. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter-in-law against her mother, a daughter-in-law rather against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake shall find it. Those are very serious words that we should think about. We should keep that in mind. Those things happened to some of our predecessors in the faith, even to death. And we can be confident that God will hold us in his hand while we do all of that, while we have to go through those things. But it's prophesied those things are going to happen again. So the question, or a question at least, we should ask ourselves is, will I leave my post? Is there something that could make me abandon my post? Will we abandon our duty when it gets hard? We must not. To this we are called, to stand to our post and do our Christian duty, come what may. We'll be there together throwing a spiritual lifeline to all who will hear God's message, and God will save some through the message and perhaps through witnessing our examples in the future. The preaching of the church, the examples of the members, the lights that we let shine. And the Bible explains that each of us will have responsibilities. Some parts are the same for every Christian. We all have the responsibility of putting God's law into practice. But sometimes we may be called to slightly different situations, and we'll have slightly different trials. Some parts will be the same for everyone. Some responsibilities and situations differ from one Christian to another as God sees fit. That's for him to decide. But all of us have been entrusted with a charge to carry. But the Bible even uses the term a load to bear. Each of us has a load to bear. Look in Galatians 6. Galatians 6, if you would, please. Galatians 6, starting in verse 3. Galatians chapter 6, verse 3. For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. We're not supposed to be comparing and saying, look, I'm doing better than you. I did this and you didn't. Verse 5, for each one shall bear his own load. Each of us has a load to carry. We have a weight. We have something we're supposed to carry forward. Each one shall bear his own load. Of course, that's not all there is to the story, because if you go back to verse 2, it also says, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. So sometimes we can help each other out with our burdens. But ultimately, each one of us has a charge to carry. I believe there will be times when we'll be able to carry each other's loads. We'll be able to help a little bit, take it on for a while, or maybe just carry each other. I don't know if we have any Lord of the Rings fans here, but maybe spiritually, it will be a little bit like Frodo and Sam when they're climbing that last stretch of Mount Doom. And Frodo says, I just can't do it. I'm out of strength. I can't go on. And Sam says, come on, Mr. Frodo. I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you. And he hoists him up on his shoulders and they stagger up the mountain. And the mission is accomplished. The ring is destroyed. I can't carry it for you, but maybe I can carry you. Maybe we'll have opportunities to do that. And we must remember we will always be in our Father's hands through all of those situations, however trying or heavy they may be. He'll be watching. He'll intervene as needed. He'll strengthen and protect in order to accomplish his perfect will through his beloved children. And what an honor it is to be counted among that number. There are so few in the world today. I mentioned to you that ultimately the worst was yet to come. Because ultimately the greatest danger to Elihu Washburn and many Parisians, the greatest danger was composed of other Parisians. After the French government signed an armistice, it had no armies left. So it didn't have enough police force to go in and reestablish order in the city of Paris. And so local groups that had composed a National Guard with what we would today call, the term didn't exist at the time, but communist sympathies, they took over Paris and they declared Paris to be a commune. It was going to be separate from the rest of France and they were going to have all things in common, basically communist, the ideas of communism were already germinating throughout Europe and they took over. They took weapons out of the armories, they moved artillery around, they tore up the bricks that made up the pavement, and they built big barricades so that troops from the rest of the country wouldn't be able to easily come back in again. And there was burning, looting, declaring independent zones here and there, some of the things we've seen happen in our own country over the last couple of years. Finally, all of Paris was taken over by what was declared to be the Paris Commune. And they called themselves, people who participated, they called themselves communards. And you may sometimes hear that word even today. It's a well-known period of history, at least for those who have communist sympathies. Most of France looked at this as a horrible time, but people with communist sympathies think, hey, we almost did it. We almost got it there. You can read more about that if you like. The legal government of France had to flee the city. They were being fired at, shot, chased out. Mobs murdered government officials. Barricades went up around the city. On March 22nd of that year, a crowd of citizens protesting the violence that was going on around the city, they moved to the headquarters of the National Guard. unarmed, just peacefully saying, this needs to stop. And the communard commander ordered his troops to open fire. So 30 unarmed people were killed in cold blood. They actually patterned themselves after the French Revolution of 1789, which we recall as the Reign of Terror. And they thought that was a good thing. They were going to do the same thing as what the revolution had done before. So they looted the city. They took hostages to keep the government from intervening. One hostage was the Catholic Archbishop of Paris. And they took him not because he'd done anything. They just thought, this is an important guy. He's leverage for us. We're just going to keep him. And finally, when it looked like they might lose, they just shot him anyway for no good reason, just because they could. So I've got a couple of slides here. If we can see the next one. So this is a result of the Commune in Paris, which created much, much more damage than the Prussians ever had. Next slide. This was the roof of the Tuileries, which is now part of the Louvre Museum. Next slide. This was City Hall in Paris that had been burned. Next slide. Some Catholic priests being shot. That was the Commune. So you see the greatest threat to Parisians turned out not to be the Prussians, turned out to be other Parisians with their own ideas. And you know what, brethren? There's a parallel there for us as well. One we should at least be aware of. I don't think it's something we have to dwell on. But one of the greatest dangers to Christians in the future will be other former Christians who abandoned their post and abandoned their duty. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The reason I mention this is because it should be extra encouragement for us to realize I've really got to make sure I do my duty. I stay at my post. Because if we don't, we will represent a danger to those who remain faithful. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come, the return of Christ, unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. A falling away. What is that talking about? What is a falling away? It's talking about Christians who fall away from Christianity. It's talking about Christians who abandon their post and turn their backs on their duty. And they go back into the world. And apparently they get towed along with this man of perdition, the beast, the false prophet that are going to come. Falling away is going to come. And we don't want to be part of that. Jesus spoke about this in a different way, similar event, but he described it a bit differently in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24, verse 9. Matthew 24, verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Then many will be offended and will betray one another and hate one another. I think the most obvious understanding of this passage, is this verse, is Christians who fall away from Christianity and they begin to hate those who haven't. Many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will wax cold. That seems to be in the context of Christianity as well. Some people are going to lose it in the stress and the temptation and the persecution that's going to come. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. You're going to betray one another and hate one another. False prophets will be confusing people. A falling away. A couple of years ago, you know, in our recent history of the church, we wondered, well, is that the falling away? Well, it probably was a precursor, but there's more to come. Coming of Christ is not going to happen unless the falling away occurs, Paul said. That's one of the signs by which you can tell we're getting closer. May have happened in part, but not all of it has happened. That kind of betrayal and that kind of persecution and tribulation hasn't happened yet, but it will. One of the greatest dangers to Christians in the future will be former Christians who abandon their post and turn their backs on their duty. We want to make sure that doesn't happen to us. You know, there are lots of zombie movies out there now. You probably know what that is, even if you haven't watched the, whatever it is, The Walking Dead or whatever. You know the idea. So there's these walking corpses. They're dead, but they're still moving around. So they call them the undead, right? So they're not exactly dead, but they're not exactly alive either. And it's pretty easy to kill a zombie. You take their head off with something sharp. If it's just one-on-one, it's not that big a deal. But when there are thousands of them after you, it gets pretty hard. And you know how this works, right? If one of them bites you, you become infected, and you turn into a zombie. And then you try and go and kill all the people you were trying to protect before, because you're just mindless. You don't know what you're doing. It's just a kind of robotic thing where you're off trying to kill as many human beings as you can. If a zombie bites you, you don't die. You turn into a zombie. And then you go on and do the same bad stuff that the zombies have been doing that you were trying to stop them from doing. You were trying to protect your friends and your family, and now you turn against them. Christians who will abandon their post will not just die. Some of them, based on what we've read here, they're going to turn against those they used to love and those they tried to protect. We must not let that happen to us. We must not become zombie Christians. But some people are going to do that. That's going to happen to some. Isaiah chapter 50 has a prophecy about the Messiah. Let's look at that. Isaiah 50. Some things that he had to go through, that he did. He was willing to do it because it was his father's will. And a very interesting phrase here that I think we should apply to ourselves. Isaiah chapter 50, starting in verse 4. The Lord God has given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak. A word in season to him who is weary. He awakens me morning by morning. He awakens my ear to hear as the learned. The Lord God has opened my ear, and I was not rebellious, nor did I turn away. I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheek to those who plucked out the beard. There's not really any reason to pluck out a beard. It's just gratuitous pain, right? Any of you men who've shaved, you know, if your razor's a little dull and you pull out a wood, oh, that smarts when you pluck out a beard. Well, there's people going to be doing this on purpose. They just want to torture somebody, make them go through pain gratuitously. I gave my back to those who struck me, my cheeks to those that plucked out the beard. I did not hide my face from shame and spitting. Those are things Jesus Christ went through. For the Lord God will help me. Therefore, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like a flint, and I know that I will not be ashamed. The Messiah set his face like flint. Flint is a very hard stone. That's why it's used to start fires. Flint and steel, when you strike those two things together, you're going to get sparks, because that stone is very, very hard. And this prophecy of the Messiah said he was going to set his face like flint. There would be no give. There would be no compromise with sin. There would be no compromise with anything wrong. He would just do God's will. Stand to his post. Do his duty. Come what may. Next slide. When Paris was finally free, the commune was finally put down, French government organized another army. There was a civil war in Paris. It went street by street by street. Thousands were killed. The last ones were lined up at the wall in a cemetery and were shot by a firing squad. And it's interesting, to this day, whenever there's a far left party organized in France, and they always have those, oftentimes their demonstrations, their marches, they end up at that wall, because to them those were heroes. In spite of all the mayhem and all of that they caused, they really admire those people. And it's also interesting to note that Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Vladimir Lenin, They studied the history of the Paris Commune very closely because they said, this is how it's going to happen. And they studied it to see, why did they blow it right at the end there? What were the weak spots? How could we make that happen again? And Lenin did manage to pull it off in Russia and the Soviet Union for a while. When Paris was finally free, though, after the bloodbath, Elihu Washburn was regarded, and rightly so, as a hero. Not all the other ambassadors who'd hightailed it out of there to go someplace safe, but he who had stayed there through thick and thin, through the difficult times. Otto von Bismarck sent him a letter thanking him for what he had done for the German citizens that were there. He wrote, His Majesty has commanded me to convey to Your Excellency the grateful acknowledgement for the zeal and kindness you have devoted to the interest of the German residents under circumstances of extraordinary difficulty and with corresponding sacrifices of time and personal comfort. Newspapers sang his praise as well. One American paper wrote, Paris was deserted by the titled and great. It witnessed starvation and death and all manner of disaster. Mr. Washburn still remained at his post, throwing himself between the ranks of arrayed Frenchmen, fighting in a horrible death struggle, saving all that he could save. The New York Tribune wrote, We do not recall an instance in our diplomacy of a more brilliant and successful performance of duty in circumstances of such gravity and delicacy. Possibly the best of all, his assistant at the American legation in Paris wrote, Hasn't our minister in Paris done splendidly? By the use of common sense, a kindly disposition, and a true appreciation of the right, he has, during the past year, brought more credit to our government and our people at home than they can ever reward him for. His name is on every tongue, and I am sure that he will not escape the fate of other honest men for whom thousands of boy babies have and will affectionately and admiringly be named. And there were a lot of Elihus after that. Washburn was offered great honors by President Grant. He turned them all down. He said, just write me a nice letter, that's all. He said, I don't want to get too famous. He finished out his time as ambassador to France, a very beloved figure. And when Grant's term came to an end, he resigned and went home for a happy retirement with his family. As I said, possibly one of the bravest Americans you've never heard of before, who did great honor to his country. The time ahead of us, brethren, is going to be challenging. There are going to be some really hard times. But after that, the reward is eternal. And that's something the Apostle Paul had in mind, very much to heart. And that's something we must never forget either. As difficult as it may seem at times, and the times we have coming ahead, we got to remember that beyond that is an eternal weight of glory. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, please. 2 Corinthians 4, starting in verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. Paul said, Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, that might seem a little curious coming from Paul. Paul's a man who was beaten and whipped and stoned, probably to death. It's likely he was even resurrected once or twice after being stoned. You know, when you were stoned, they weren't throwing, you know, pebbles at you. These were big stones to break your bones and crush your skull. He went through that several times. And yet, he says, our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And that's what we need to focus on. President John Kennedy, addressing a group of soldiers, told them, "Do not pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger men." And that's true for us as well. Don't pray for an easy life. Pray to be a stronger Christian. Let's pray to be stronger Christians so that we can armor up with a key to spiritual strength the resolution and the commitment that we can ask God to give us so that we will always stand to our post and do our duty, come what may.